This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Extreme heat lingers over half the world's people. India is rocket hot again, China, all of Southeast Asia with records. Even Scotland is abnormally hot with wildfires. The world is developing a fever. The cause is known. The atmosphere is being poisoned with fossil carbon. It is a sickness. And we have a doctor in the house. Our guest, Peter Carter, is the director of the Climate Emergency Institute. He is a relentless climate communicator. From Victoria, British Columbia, Dr. Peter Carter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for the intro.
You were a medical doctor for decades. Then you became a climate campaigner. How did that come about?
Pretty naturally. As a medical doctor and working in Canada, particularly in areas of forestry and pulp mills, and so I got involved in air pollution long time ago because of the damage that the pulp mills and the fires to some extent were doing to the populations there. So I learned a great deal. Then I was a founding member of CAPE, Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, and I became their sort of point man on federal and provincial consultations on environmental health, which at the time was very big because Canada was rewriting its Environmental Protection Act, writing its first Endangered Species Act. So I learned a lot, sort of the hard way. And then it was just natural, of course, to move into global warming, from air pollution to global warming. And it's very interesting, most people don't think of climate change in terms of pollution, which is a pity because it is the greatest pollution we've ever known, and we do know how to handle pollution, but we're not, of course, handling climate change. The only person, and I've been talking climate change pollution, greenhouse gas pollution for a long time, so I was very gratified when last week Arnie Schwarzenegger made a statement that we're using the wrong terms. We should be talking pollution, not climate change. How about that?
That's really interesting. You know, I've got to be honest here, Peter. A few years ago, I wondered if you were a bit too extreme, maybe an alarmist. And you still say we're in an insane global suicide scenario. But given the apocalyptic scenes that are playing out in the nightly news, it sounds about right. Is there time to sound the alarm?
Oh, there's always time to sound the alarm. The alarm really has never been sounded. And, of course, that is, to my mind, the terrible legacy of the highly successful but malevolent climate change campaign. As a result of that, effective communication, sort of enthusiastic communication, has really not got going pretty well anywhere for climate change. And so we continue to be in a planet and future killing situation. There's no question about that with the science now. One of the things that I've spent most of my time doing now on climate change is monitoring all the climate change indicators, of which there are a lot. And they're monitored by NOAA and NASA, et cetera, you know, on a regular basis. So I keep a track on those, and I post them all every month on one of my websites. It's absolutely shocking. Shocked me to the core, the way things are going. We're at an all-time high on all of our climate change indicators, and they're increasing at an all-time high rate. It is completely, absolutely insane. You know, I co-authored the book in 2018 on unprecedented crime, climate change denial, and the crime just gets horrendously worse. I don't think we're thinking about our future much. Maybe we're not sort of programmed to do that, but it's a terrible shame that we don't think about our children and grandchildren or all the children in the world. The legacy of the planet that they're going to be left with is absolutely terrible, terrible.
You talk to some people and they tell you how much they love their kids and their grandkids, but they're not really willing to make any life changes that will make their lives less of a hell from climate change. How do you see the massive wildfires in Canada this year?
The penny hasn't dropped that this is a global catastrophe. The fires that are burning right across Canada and right across Canada now, which of course is a vast country, they're actually burning the boreal forest. The boreal forest is our largest forest by far our largest carbon sink. Now, we have two big carbon sinks, or had two big carbon sinks on our planet. One was the Amazon and tropical rainforest. That's not sinking carbon anymore. There's so much damage, mainly human-caused damage, but also environmental, to those rainforests that, whereas they were a massive carbon sink, reducing atmospheric carbon dioxide, even in the face of our increasing emissions. So for quite some time now, the boreal forest, this wonderful, massive forest, goes in the north, or circumpolar forest, all the way around the planet. That is our absolutely vital future survival carbon sink. And these fires, of course, are going to continue burning all through the summer. People talk about some rain and stuff like that, which is good, but every day I look at them, they're just the same, just the same. And the amount of pollution, which I'm also working on, that they're pouring out is incredible, unbelievable. The satellites are picking up CO2, atmospheric CO2 emissions, from these fires. That's a thing that, my knowledge, has never happened before. For the satellites to do that, these fires must be massive and must be intense. And the pollution, which is tracked best by the European Copernicus satellite, the pollution is unprecedented, completely unbelievable. The pollutants that are pouring out. It's a catastrophe for Canada, that's for sure. You know, there was an unprecedented, practically across all of the United States, air quality issue. That's never happened before. So we have, the word, of course, for climate change is unprecedented, obviously. Damaging the boreal forest is something we're not going to get over.
I recently saw a drought map for Europe. Huge parts of France, Germany, and Eastern Europe are in the most extreme state of drought. We could see a lot of fires in Europe and Scandinavia this year. Your thoughts?
Well, on drought, my thoughts are that I follow the drought maps, mainly the NASA GRACE satellites. The last drought map that I published yesterday, all of Western Canada is in the most severe drought, and Quebec is also in fairly severe drought. And then the heat as well matches. So I just want to mention this. These fires are heat and drought driven. They're occurring against the background of severe heat and severe drought. So yeah, Europe is, according to the headlines, bracing for another severe year of heat and drought. Now, for Europe, the future is looking completely ghastly. Europe is heating faster than any other sort of equivalent region in the world. It's heating up extremely fast. And, of course, at the same time, it's now getting these severe, extensive droughts. And I was reading, actually, the drought expert just a couple of days ago, and Europe's actually been in these droughts for decades, this particular drought for decades. I mean, obviously, you know, when the summer comes, everybody hears about it. But there's a drought in Europe that's not going away.
Incredibly, the next climate summit will be headed by a man who runs a national oil and gas company. So the fossil fuel companies are not just a lobby group at climate talks with their voice. Now they are literally running the COP conference. Should we just ignore those talks as corrupt?
I wish we could, but we can't afford to do that. You're absolutely right, of course. In the early days, in the 80s and 90s, as you know, the fossil fuels corporations, with their huge power, decided to persuade the governments and the public that there was nothing to worry about with respect to global warming. And they've been pretty well managing and controlling the issue ever since. Two results of that, the one that you already mentioned, although the people that work in the climate change secretariat, great people, no question, but it's hard on them, particularly that the conferences have been set up to fail. They cannot achieve anything. because governments, big economy governments, big fossil fuel using governments, because of the way that the negotiations are set up. Can you imagine we're negotiating the future of the planet? We're negotiating the future of humanity. It's completely absurd and totally wrong. But they managed to push through a voting system, which is completely insane. You may have heard of it, because the media's been pretty good on it, that a vote to pass anything requires the agreement of every single nation. Hence, we never get anything voted on. So we've been at this with the convention, which in 92, I was very encouraged. It was a very good, strong convention. I thought this is going to be really good. You know, we can work with this, and this isn't watered-down, sloppy language. This is a real good convention. But, of course, we've had 30 years, and we have achieved absolutely nothing, nothing, except that we've been watching the greenhouse gas emissions continue to pollute the atmosphere. There's another reason for calling the situation pollution, by the way, because, of course, air pollution, we've known for decades and decades, air pollution specifically from fossil fuels is now killing 10 million people a year. Now, if that's not a crime, if that's not a manifest terrible evil, then nothing is, and it is. It is. So we are not managing to get anywhere with reducing the emissions from the fossil fuel industry. CO2 last year, again, was at an all-time high. Our governments, you know, incredibly, are supporting the fossil fuel industry. As the planet burns, I was reading a headline yesterday that our leader of Ontario over the past week has heated up, and so we now have more fires in Ontario. So it now really is right across Canada. I saw that he was pushing investments in what is the most horrible industry of all, which is burning biomass for energy. So like I've been saying, we're really on a suicide scenario. It's a global suicide scenario.
Okay, so some listeners are pessimistic about the ability of the civilization to change. They think a collapse of industrial society may be the only chance to avoid extinction-level warming. But if the net breaks down and fuel deliveries stop, there would be a huge cost in human lives. Is collapse an option, or do you think it will happen anyway?
Yeah, you make a good point. We've had some recent examples where, you know, governments have tried to sort of do a better thing. You can't switch our complex economy at the flick of a switch. It has to be progressive and sensibly managed, which, of course, won't be an easy thing. But it can be done, and it always could be done readily. The change can be readily made as long as it's carefully managed, as I say. But our government's, of course, completely useless and hopeless. That's simply because we've known for many decades that all of our fossil fuel energy can be totally 100% replaced by clean, renewable energy, which then, of course, also stops the millions of people that are being killed by air pollution every day. The only thing that's keeping the, I'm not an economist or businessman, but it's pretty obvious that the only thing that's keeping the fossil fuel industry in business is the vast subsidies that our governments are giving. That is a great evil, that our own governments are using our money to prop up the fossil fuel industry, which is wrecking the planet and destroying the future. So it's always been readily possible to do, as long as governments do it in a proper way. But I don't see that happening. Our governments are doing all the wrong things. It seems that our governments are more interested in sending your soldiers to kill each other than to save the future of the human race.
Well, let me give a personal case study here. My wife and I need a vehicle to bring supplies to our rural home, and those supplies come from a fossil-powered world, and we are a long way from affording an electric car that works for country life. So we feel like hostages. We have to participate in the carbon-burning game to live. Do you have any words for us living these conflicted lives?
Yeah, absolutely. The only solution, the only remedy to global climate change is up to the governments and leaders. It's entirely up to our governments and our corporations, fossil fuel corporations, our big banking corporations. Look, we all have to do what's right. You know, we all have to do the best we can. But if we all do our best, the planet's still going down unless our governments and corporations change. You see, I mentioned the significant effect of government subsidies. Pretty well everything in our world now is done on credit. It's done from money from the banks. And it was quite a shock to me when I learned some years ago that all of these massive fossil fuel extraction projects, you know, fracking, we've got big-time fracking in northeastern British Columbia, of course. It's all done on borrowed money. All of this money, which is being invested into destroying our future, it's actually coming from the big banks, and they stay way below the radar. Although there is a group of environmental organizations who do a great job. They're called BankTrack, and they issue a very complete assessment of the amount of money that all of these banks are giving to the fossil fuel industry to keep the fossil fuel industry and the planet burning. So we have to do our best, but we have to appreciate that our best is limited because we work in and are effectively controlled by this particular system, which we call the economy. Now, environmentalists have always realized, worked hard, published countless articles, and published countless books on the fact that this is a thoroughly bad economy. It's an economy that doesn't work for most of the people in the world, and it certainly doesn't work for the future because it's an inherently destructive economy. You know, it can be simply explained that the economy has one aim only, and that is to make the maximum amount of monetary profit every second of every day without any other considerations whatsoever. So that's a formula for disaster of civilization and the human race. But we haven't managed, despite all the tremendous work that many, many people have done on this to point out how crazy this is, we haven't managed to change it one bit. In actual fact, of course, it's just been getting worse and worse and worse, particularly with economic globalization, which has now been going for 25 years or more. The power has been forced out of our hands, out of the people's hands, and even out of the government's hands by corporations. If you want to read a good book about that, the book is When Corporations Rule the World by David C. Corton. And he wrote that. It's a great book. He's a super economist. We do have some great economists, but they don't get listened to and they don't get their formulas put into operation. So we live in a world which is, Corton was right, certainly today is run by the corporations.
Years ago, I interviewed Dr. Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. As a paleoclimatologist, Peter Ward found many cases of species driving themselves into extinction or times when nature just so rearranged the climate that there were mass extinction events. He suggested that, as opposed to James Lovelock, that life looks after itself, that life has a habit of killing itself off and then trying some new species. Do you think humans can still avoid that trap?
I'm trying to remember the name of Peter Ward's book. It was a great, great book.
Under a Green Sky was his first book. What
yeah,
a fantastic
yeah,
book.
He was really good, very, very interesting. Yeah, of course, we are in the sixth extinction now, and the sixth extinction, there's no question about it. You know, we were first advised about that in the late 80s. We now, of course, have the definitive published peer review science, and the top paper, which came out of Stanford, was called the Sixth Extinction, Annihilation of Vertebrate Life. When scientists peer-reviewed are allowed to use the word annihilation, you know it's got to be happening. And it has. I mean, it's so sad and tragic and upsetting. Life is disappearing all around us. I moved from England to the wonderful, attractive country of Canada and then onto the even more wonderful, attractive province of British Columbia. And, you know, British Columbia was teeming with life, right? Everywhere you went, land, forests, lakes, oceans, just fabulous. But that life is crashed, you know? So I'm lucky I live in a lovely place in Victoria. We rent apartment in one of these fabulous old mansions, and it's got a wonderful big wild area with gary oak trees and big grasses. But, you know, I consider myself lucky if I see one butterfly a day. A week ago, I saw two swallows. You know the famous thing? One swallow doesn't make a spring or summer, whatever it is. Well, nowadays, one or two swallows does, because that's all we see. And, of course, you know, the marine environment here has collapsed terribly. Never got over the huge marine heat wave that went right up and down the west coast there. And so, life seems to have a habit of crashing. Luckily, it also is totally amazing. I mean, if you're going to use the word miraculous, this is where to use it, that life survives and comes back. And it seems it comes back in sort of more glorious forms. Certainly, you know, the Earth and the planet, the Cenozoic age, which we have all lived in, is the richest age with regards to what's called biodiversity and life now. But, of course, that is disappearing at what the scientists think is probably the fastest rate. The biodiversity life has declined.
I follow your tweets, and I find that they're usually accompanied by links to new science that the mainstream misses, and sometimes I miss completely. Just recently, you had one that was, quote, an update of large-scale indicators of the state of the climate system and human influence. And that was peer-reviewed science, just published June 8th, 2023. Do you have tips for our listeners of places they can go to get the real information when the mainstream doesn't cover it?
Yeah, there are two best places. One is Science Daily. They carry, they headline and link and explain, actually, a very, very good way. But they're just excellent. The most important science in all areas, including biodiversity. And, of course, environmentalism in general they do, and population they do. They pretty well do it all. Of course, they're very good on climate change. So I rely on Science Daily very, very much. The other source, which has always been great, is called The New Scientist. That's a science magazine published with the intent so that people in general are able to understand all the important stuff which the science is publishing, and that's a very good source. So we are overwhelmed with the amount of science, and I am literally, that's coming in every day, all the bad news. We're underwhelmed by the scientific community really doing anything or recommending actions on a scientific basis, which we know will temper the situation and maybe give us a chance of a good future survival. So that's where we're lacking. Of course, we have the IPCC. You know, they come out every 5 or so years. And over the years, they have done a better job at making the science, and more and more that they have to assess, of making the science accessible and understanding by the general public. So that's good. But if you go to the IPCC, go to the FAQs, go to the frequently asked questions. They're good, they're easily readable, they're not terribly long for every report. And the other thing that they've started doing in the past 10 or so years is they do something called headline statements, so go there too. You don't have to wade through all of the voluminous, complicated science of climate change that the IPCC records and assesses every year. You go to those two and you'll get what you need.
Peter Carter, tell us about the Climate Emergency Forum broadcast that you're putting out on YouTube.
Yeah. In 2008, when James Hansen for the first time, made a public statement in which he says, yes, We are in a state of planetary emergency. At the time, I mean, I'd been working scientifically on the environmental pollution degradation issues. So I was very, very happy when that happened. I was very unhappy that I noticed that Hansen sort of traveled the world, and he got no support whatsoever from his scientific colleagues. You know, I don't know how James Hansen carries on all these years. I mean, he's still in his 80s. But I really felt for him on that, and I thought, what can I do? And I realized, well, you know, I could start an institute, Climate Emergency Institute. So I set that up, and I set it up with writers and contributions from the developing world, from the most vulnerable world, because I realized, as many people realized at the time and still do, that their voice is absolutely not strong enough. You know, my friends and family thought it was a bit of a crazy idea, but it turned out to be very worthwhile. And, yeah, I do spend a lot of time on it. People have asked me for decades, don't you get depressed working on all this stuff, you know? Don't you get anxious? Well, it's really terrible that, of course, our young people, they understand what's going on. They are now suffering from what's called climate change anxiety. But the answer, of course, is to get involved and get active. If you get active on an issue, I don't think it matters how bad it is. Mentally and emotionally, you're going to be okay.
We're going to have to leave it there. From Victoria, Canada, we have been speaking with the director of the Climate Emergency Institute, Dr. Peter Carter. You can find out more at www.climateemergencyinstitute.com and in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for the pertinent questions. I'll follow your show.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.